am the Greek goddess Harmonia. By the miracle of your technology, I can speak to you from behind the veil. Come sit with me for a few minutes for another episode of The Golden Thread. Hello, my friend. Welcome back. Last time we sat together in the quiet. We followed a young monk into the mountains of Japan and we learned something about stillness, about how presence itself, just sitting, just breathing, just being, can be a form of prayer. Dogen taught that. He lived it. And I think it stayed with you, just a little. Today we travel a long way from those mountains. We're going back, further back, to a world of desert light and ancient cities, of monks who wrote by lamplight and argued about the nature of God with the same intensity that other men argued about land and water. To a corner of Syria where one man had a vision so large, so luminous, so stubbornly merciful that the most powerful voices of his tradition sat down and wrote letters telling everyone to ignore him. They didn't quite succeed. His name was Stephen Bar Sudeley, and the story of what he believed and what happened to it is one of the most quietly remarkable threads I have ever watched move through this tapestry. Pull up a chair. This one is worth your time. I want to tell you about a book. Not the book Stephen wrote, not yet. I want to tell you about a moment, a cold morning, somewhere in Syria, sometime in the 13th century, 800 years after Stephen lived and wrote and was condemned and died. A monk sits at a desk, in front of him an old manuscript. The pages are worn soft as cloth from handling. The ink in places has faded to the color of weak tea. Some of the edges have crumbled away entirely, words lost, sentences broken mid-thought, whole passages gone back to dust. The book is fragile, the way very old things are fragile. You don't so much hold it as receive it. He has read it. He knows what it says. He knows what the authorities of his tradition said about it, and now he's going to copy it. He reaches for the vellum. I want you to understand what that means. Vellum is not paper. You cannot walk to a shop and buy a stack of it. Vellum is skin, calf skin most often, sometimes lamb. The animal has to be slaughtered, the hide soaked in lime to loosen the hair, scraped carefully, patiently, the blade held at just the right angle, stretched on a frame while still wet, scraped again as it dries, thinned until it is almost translucent. One animal yields perhaps two or three large sheets. A book of any size requires a flock, half a flock of sheep, gone to pages. That is not a small thing in a monastery. That is winter meat. That is wool. That is a conversation with the shepherd, a weighing of needs, a decision made by more than one person. And then the time. The short gray days of Assyrian winter. The ink kept warm so it will flow. The reed pen held just so. The letters formed one by one, each line ruled carefully on the vellum with a bone stylus before the writing begins. No rushing. A page a day, perhaps, on a good day. This book, this worn, condemned, fragile book, will take months to copy. Perhaps all winter. The monk sits with it for a moment before he begins. I watched him. I remember the way he rested his hand on the old pages without quite pressing down, the way he looked at the first blank sheet of new vellum, white and waiting and expensive. And then he picked up his pen. I have thought about that moment many times since. All that cost, all that care, all that quiet, deliberate, chosen labor for a book that the great voices of Syrian Christianity had condemned 8 centuries before. Who was this Stephen, I wonder? What did he write that made it worth all of this? Let me tell you. Stephen Bar Sudeley was born into a world that took God very seriously. That probably sounds like an obvious thing to say, but I want you to feel what I mean by it. This was not a world where faith was a private matter, something you kept to yourself on Sunday mornings. In late 5th century Syria, theology was public. It was urgent. It was the kind of thing men argued about in the streets, in the markets, in the long colonnaded courtyards of monasteries where the smell of lamp oil and bread and old stone all mixed together in the heat. Edessa was that kind of city. It sat near the headwaters of the Euphrates in the region we now call southeastern Turkey, and it was one of the great intellectual centers of the Christian East. Not Rome, not Constantinople, something older, stranger, more tangled with the roots of the faith. Edessa had its own ancient tradition of Christianity, its own liturgical language, Syriac, a dialect of Aramaic, the language Jesus himself most likely spoke. When scholars in Edessa argued about the nature of God, they were arguing in words that carried the texture of the oldest layers of the faith. Stephen grew up in that world. We don't know much about his early life. The tapestry is thin here, the threads worn. What we know is that he was a monk, that he was educated, that he could write, and that somewhere in the course of his formation, he arrived at ideas that his tradition was not quite ready for. He left Edessa eventually. He made his way to Jerusalem. Jerusalem was always a place people went when they needed to start again, or when they had something to prove, or when the city they came from had grown too small for what they were carrying. Stephen went there as a monk and settled into the community of the holy city. He taught, he wrote letters back to his friends in Edessa. He gathered around him people who were drawn to his vision of things, and his vision was large. Two ideas in particular drew the attention of the authorities. The first was his teaching about punishment. Stephen did not believe that the suffering of sinners after death was eternal. It had a limit. It had a purpose. It was, in some sense, corrective rather than simply retributive. This alone was enough to raise eyebrows. The idea of hell without a final wall made certain people very uncomfortable. But it was the second idea that really alarmed them. Stephen taught that all of nature, everything that exists, every creature, every stone, every star, was consubstantial with the divine essence, that the entire universe had emanated from God, and that in the end, everything would return to God and be absorbed back into that original unity. Nothing lost, nothing permanently excluded, the whole of creation on a vast, slow journey home. Two of the most eminent men in Syrian Christianity heard this and sat down to write letters. Jacob of Sirig was a poet and a bishop, one of the most beloved voices of his tradition. They called him the flute of the Holy Spirit. Philoxenus of Mabug was a theologian of formidable reputation, precise and fierce and deeply serious about the boundaries of right belief. Both of them wrote to warn the faithful. Both of them named Stephen. Both of them said in the careful language of ecclesiastical condemnation, "This man has gone too far." Stephen kept writing anyway. Here is what I have learned watching this long story unfold across the centuries. Ideas that carry genuine weight do not die easily. You can condemn them. You can write letters against them. You can expurgate them, abridge them, garble them into something safer and more manageable. You can let 800 years pass without anyone speaking them aloud in public. They wait. Stephen's great work, the book we now call the Book of Hierotheus, the book he almost certainly wrote under a borrowed name, claiming the authority of a disciple of St. Paul because he knew his own name would close doors before anyone read a single line, that book survived in exactly one manuscript, one. A single copy made in the 13th century by that monk we met at the beginning, sitting at his desk with his vellum and his reed pen and his quiet, costly decision. One copy was enough. The book describes the soul's journey in five long movements. It begins with emanation, the breathtaking moment when all of existence pours forth from the divine source like light from a lamp, like music from a single sustained note. It moves through the long middle passage of life, the mind in motion, searching, struggling, gathering itself towards something it can feel but not yet see. And it ends with return, the slow, magnificent homecoming, the soul rising through stages of union, shedding the weight of separateness, until finally, all distinct existence dissolves back into what the book calls the chaos of the good. That phrase has stayed with me for 15 centuries. The chaos of the good, not a cold mathematical unity, not an empty silence, something warm and wild and overflowing, a goodness so complete that our ordinary categories of self and other, here and there, mine and yours, simply stop making sense inside it. Stephen was not alone in feeling this. That is the thing I want you to notice. Theodosius, Patriarch of Antioch, a man who lived four centuries after Stephen, a man who held one of the highest offices in Eastern Christianity, read the Book of Hierotheus and wrote a commentary on it. Not a condemnation, a commentary, sympathetic, engaged, wrestling seriously with the ideas inside it. He saw something in Stephen's vision worth sitting with. Bar Hebraeus, the great Miaphysite scholar of the 13th century, the same century our monk made his copy, got hold of the book and abridged it. He cut the most unorthodox passages. He softened the edges. He made it safer. But here is the thing about Bar Hebraeus. He was one of the most learned men of his age. He had read everything. He could have simply ignored Stephen's book, or written against it, or let it continue its quiet slide toward oblivion. Instead, he engaged with it. He preserved a version of it. Even in the act of expurgating, he was saying, "This matters enough to handle carefully." And quietly, in the background of all this, the same thread was appearing in other places. I had watched it before. I recognized it, the sense of a cosmos oriented toward return, of love as the fundamental gravity of existence, of no soul finally beyond the reach of mercy. I had seen this in the Neoplatonists in Origen a few centuries before Stephen, in the Sufi poets who would come centuries after. It surfaced in different languages, different centuries, different traditions. Always a little dangerous, always a little too large for the official containers, always insisting on itself anyway. Stephen did not invent this thread. He found it the way certain people find things that were always there, waiting to be noticed by someone paying close enough attention. And he wove it into his tradition with such care, such genuine inner conviction, that even condemnation could not pull it out cleanly. 8 centuries later, a monk who knew all of this sat down in a cold scriptorium and reached for his vellum. He had read the book, he had felt the pull of it, and he made his choice. 1 copy, still here, still speaking. That is not nothing, that is, in fact, everything. Let me ask you something. When someone you loved died, and I think you have lost someone, most people have, by the time they find a podcast like this one, what did you imagine happened to them? Not what you were taught, not the official answer. What did you actually imagine in the quiet of the night when the grief was fresh and the world felt thin and close? I have watched a great many people face that moment, across centuries, across traditions, across every kind of belief and doubt and careful theological position. And here is what I have noticed. Almost nobody, in the private geography of their grief, reaches for punishment. Almost nobody stands at the edge of that loss and thinks, "I hope they are getting what they deserved." They reach for continuation, for movement, for the image of a soul that has not stopped, but simply crossed. Passed through something, arrived somewhere the living cannot yet follow. The official theologies vary enormously. The private instinct, remarkably, does not. And I find that interesting. I find it very interesting indeed. Stephen Barsudeli was not the first person to feel what you feel in those moments. He was simply one of the few who wrote it down carefully enough and stubbornly enough that a monk 8 centuries later thought it worth half a flock of sheep to preserve. What Stephen put into words was something that ordinary human love keeps arriving at on its own, without any theological training, without any instruction at all, that the soul is not a stone. It does not simply stop, that the crossing is not an ending, but a hinge, the place where the long arc of a life turns from outward to inward, from journey to return, that whatever this existence is, it is moving somewhere. And the direction of that movement, if you follow it far enough, if you trust the pull of it, is towards something that deserves to be called home. This is not a comfortable idea for institutions. It never has been. Institutions need walls. They need boundaries that mean something, consequences that hold, a map with clear edges. Stephen's vision has a way of making walls feel smaller than love, and that makes certain people nervous in every age, in every tradition. But the walls keep failing to convince us. Not because we are undisciplined or naive, because we have loved specific people, because we have held the hand of someone crossing over and felt in that unbearable and sacred moment that what we were witnessing was not an ending. Because grief itself, when you go all the way down into it, has a strange quality of expansion, as if the person you lost has not shrunk to nothing but grown somehow larger, less bounded, more present in a way that makes no rational sense and yet feels more true than almost anything else you know. Stephen would have recognized that feeling. He spent his life trying to find words for it. The world has grown in its slow way toward his instinct. Not uniformly. Not without resistance. The punitive visions are still with us and probably always will be. But something has shifted in the broad human conversation about what love requires of a cosmos. The circle in most hearts keeps wanting to be wider than the official maps allow. the mercy keeps wanting to reach further than the boundaries permit. That is not a modern invention. It is an ancient recognition, surfacing again and again in people who go deep enough into their own experience of love to find it waiting there. Stephen found it in a desert monastery in Jerusalem 15 centuries ago. He wrote it down. He sent letters about it to his friends. He got condemned for it. And somewhere in Syria, 800 years later, a monk read those words and reached for his vellum. He knew what he was doing. He knew the cost. He did it anyway. Because some truths are worth half a flock of sheep, and some homecomings are worth the whole long winter of waiting. I want to leave you with something to carry, not an assignment, not a theological position to adopt or defend, just a question to keep in your pocket for a while and take out occasionally and turn over in your hands. Have you ever held a vision too large for the room you were in? Not necessarily a religious vision. It doesn't have to be that. It could be a conviction about how people ought to treat one another, a sense that the circle of who deserves care and dignity is wider than the people around you were drawing it, a feeling, quiet but persistent, that love, real love, the kind that costs something, doesn't actually have a wall at the edge of it. Maybe you said it out loud once and the room got uncomfortable. Maybe you learned to say it more carefully or less often or only to certain people. Maybe you filed it away somewhere private and just lived with it, the way you live with something that is too true to abandon and too large to fully explain. Stephen Barsudeli lived with it too. For his whole adult life, in the heat of Edessa and the ancient dust of Jerusalem, he carried this vision of a cosmos so saturated with divine love that nothing could fall permanently outside it. It cost him the approval of the most respected voices of his tradition. It cost him the comfort of belonging without asterisks. He carried it anyway. I am not saying you are Stephen. I am not saying your quiet conviction, whatever it is, will survive in a single manuscript for 15 centuries. Most of our private truths don't get copied onto vellum by devoted strangers. But I am saying this. The fact that something is too large for the room does not make it wrong. The fact that the official map doesn't include it does not mean the territory isn't there. And the fact that you have felt even once, even briefly, even in the thin hours of grief or love or inexplicable certainty, that the circle is wider than anyone told you. That is not nothing. That is perhaps the most important thing you know. Next time we are going somewhere very different. We are going to Spain, to the 16th century. To a moment when the Catholic Church, vast and powerful and increasingly anxious about the boundaries of right belief, found itself confronting something it didn't quite know what to do with. A practice, a way of praying, a method of turning the soul so completely inward that the whole noisy world, the liturgy, the priests, the sacraments, the institutions, fell away to silence. And in that silence, something waited. They called it recogimiento, the gathering inward, the collected self. It was not rebellion. The people who practiced it were faithful, devoted, deeply serious about their tradition. They simply believed that the most direct path to God ran not through the cathedral, but through the interior of the soul itself. Sound familiar? Stephen would have smiled, I think. Come back and find out what happened when an entire movement of interior mystics collided with an institution that preferred its maps to have clear edges. It is, as these stories often are, equal parts beautiful and heartbreaking, and equal parts worth knowing. I have loved sitting with you in this story today. Stephen Barsudeli, condemned, careful, stubborn, luminous, left us one thin thread, one manuscript, one monk's quiet decision on a cold winter morning. And here we are, 15 centuries later, still pulling it. That is what threads do. When they are true, they hold. Much love. I am Harmonia. Oh, thank you for listening, dear one. If this episode meant something to you, I'd love it if you'd leave a 5-star rating. It helps more people find their way here. And if you subscribe, you will never miss a thread and share this story with someone you love. One more thing, my friend, look in your episode notes. There's a link there that leads back to our little community. Leave a comment. I promise. I read everyone. This podcast sails out to you from Red Buoy Media, LLC. The stories we share are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, share-alike 4.0 international. That means you can pass them along, remix them, and even argue with them. Just give us credit, don't try to sell them, and share responsibly. Thanks for listening, friend. Until our next adventure.